When Solomon was granted wisdom, God said that he had more wisdom than all the men of the East, which is kind of an interesting statement and probably bears its own comments, but I will say that a lot of the religions of the East tend to be meditational religions. You can't meditate your way into contact with God if you're not converted, but they are religions that basically are founded more on thinking about things, taking the time to think things through, at least humanly. And as a result, you will find that a lot of proverbs from the East, from the Orient, have a certain kind of wisdom in them. That said, there is perhaps one proverb that is my favorite. It is a Chinese proverb. You know, when we were kids, we used to say, Confucius say, and then we would have fun and tell jokes. Well, Confucius was a great, I put that in quotes, a great philosopher and really the founder of a kind of religion of the East. But he was not the only Chinese religionist or philosopher who came up with important proverbs. And one of the ones, maybe the one I would call my favorite, is even the longest journey begins with a single step. Now you might consider that. Even the longest journey begins with a single step. I think I've heard a variation of that. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. So I've heard two different forms of it, but it's really the same thing. There's no question that if you want to get literally from here to there, wherever here is and wherever there is, it starts with a single step. Sometimes that step isn't even in the right direction, but you have to take that step in order to learn that you're going in the wrong direction. Sometimes recognizing that the journey of 1,000 miles became the journey of 1,100 miles because you weren't even walking in the right direction and you had to turn around. And then as you become more confident, you can move faster and your steps can be longer and you can take the analogy anywhere you want to go. Now, stop for a moment and let's consider something. I've had to kind of pep talk myself a little bit over recent months and maybe even recent weeks. As things fall more and more into place here in the office, we get past two separate waves of internal attacks. And of course, there are all kinds of people attacking us ferociously here and there because we are now, let's face it, let's be candid. We are the custodians of what a lot of people once believed but have lost sight of. And there is a great being who hates that, who thought he had stamped it out, but now finds he did not. And so I find myself wishing against sometimes this persecution, these attacks, these roadblocks and hurdles, that we could move faster, that we could accomplish more and sooner. I just do. But I must tell you, then I have to look back at Mr. Armstrong. I'm going to reread his autobiography. I've just decided I'm going to bite off the whole, 1,000 pages. I'm going to reread it again because I've read various snapshots of it and they always wind up encouraging me. But Mr. Armstrong saw the church grow very, very slowly for many years. How slowly? Some among us, and I would almost at times have to say, at least in the first 8 of our nearly 16 months, we're 15 and a half months old, I wish we would grow faster. But we are probably bigger after 15 and a half months than the entirety of the then Radio Church of God was after almost 18 years. Now just stop and savor that statistic. A lot of people today are caught up in the idea of growth and growth that comes fast. I've never seen anybody, as I said in last week's sermon, who wants to not see growth. Everybody wants to see growth. But most people not only want to see growth, they want to see it fast. Politicians are elected based on their ability to bring more growth faster. And woe unto any politician in this economy who doesn't bring a lot more growth. There are a lot of people crediting themselves with the growth that we see around us today in the United States that may have actually been the product of things that were done in the 80s. I'm not a politician, so I'm not going to take sides, but a lot of people want to take credit for growth, and people tend to be oriented toward growth. But you know something? Mr. Armstrong had 18 years from approximately January 1934 until about that same time in 1952 before the Radio Church of God was as big as we are now. I mean, we haven't even had a month to grow to the same size for every year that he had. He did not have to work against the internet instantaneously trying to discredit him, say things about him, leaving him with the tremendous difficulty of trying to counter, and then finally realizing, knowing Mr. Armstrong, he would have said, I can't counter them anyway, everything that he did. And for a lot of that time, he did not have to go out and find staff. It was years before he had to go find staff. We had to sort of instantly do it. Now, I have said before, but it's been a while since I've said it, so a lot of newer people who are with us may not know this. I had no idea when I was fired whether 50 people would hold fast and we'd basically be a group in Akron, or whether we would grow very rapidly or grow slowly but keep growing, or anything at all. I just knew I wasn't going to compromise, and then God was going to have to make up the rest. I had no idea that we were going to grow as fast and as suddenly as we did, to the point where a lot of things had to fall in place. But I will tell you, this complex fell into place a lot quicker than the staff that would have been necessary, the kind of loyal staff that would be necessary to take care of those people. And I'm going to tell you, it's been the hardest 15 and a half months of my entire life, and no other 15 and a half month period has even remotely been close to it. I mean, I've been through some tough stuff in my life. And I wonder, why isn't it happening faster? And then I stop and I have to remember 15 and a half months. Mr. Armstrong had nearly 18 years, and I begin to feel grateful that we have done as much as we have. Now, I get a lot of letters from people thanking us for all we're doing, but we have people among us who are impatient, and maybe that's natural. It's partly the age. It's kind of the old adage that governs our age, God, give me patience and give it to me now. And that's the way a lot of people are. Why aren't we doing more work? Why aren't we buying this, doing that? I stop and think of how groups that are much bigger, much wealthier, much older, larger ministries, larger staff, aren't doing nearly as much as we are, and yet we have some among us who are impatient that we do more. And I've had to just slow down and recognize we're probably doing way more humanly than we should even be trying to bite off. And yet for some, it's kind of, let's go, more, more. I'm sure some are going to the feast expecting to see huge groups. We're not going to be huge groups. We're going to have people keeping the feast in probably six, maybe seven locations, although if you count a few scattered people, like one in India, one in New Zealand, and maybe one or two here or there in other countries who can't get anywhere, maybe we'll have people keeping the feast in 8 or 9 or 10 places. Last year we had 3. But if people are expecting throngs at the feast because we've just suddenly soared, it's because of an expectation that they have retained that is artificial. Prophecy has moved on. Eras have moved on. The age and time that we live in has moved on. It's no longer the time of the sixth era. People have been beaten up too often and too badly to just stampede toward us. And frankly, brethren, if a lot of people came rushing toward us, probably most of them we wouldn't want because they're not of us. A large percentage of the people who came with us in the first 8 months we existed did not have the tools that people have today, and therefore did not know what they were getting into. Or maybe they thought we weren't serious about holding fast, and as a result have left us. They've just left us. They're gone. They never should have come with us, but at least they were honest enough to say, hey, I don't agree with that. We had a group when I said I was wrong, we should not be wearing makeup, who just said, hey, adios, you're changing the rules. One family looked me right in the eye and said, you're changing the rules, as though it was my fault, and left, and impacted 2 or 3 other families. So we've lost some people. We had some people come with us because the CDs, was why they were here. There were others who came with us because we were going to immediately, no matter what, publish all of Mr. Armstrong's literature. One way or the other, we're going to publish what Mr. Armstrong wrote. It's going to be published, and it's going to be taken to the world again. I'm just going to tell you that. But there are some people who only want his exact words. In other words, it's not the truth if it's written the way Paul would write it, or John would write it, or Peter, or James, or Jude. It has to be the truth written the way Mr. Armstrong would write it, or it's not the truth. I mean, God knows I don't want to have to rewrite all of Mr. Armstrong's 52 years of his ministry. It's like some people think I have a need to spend hundreds and hundreds of hours rewriting all of that material, maybe so I can sort of put my signature on the work. Ghastly. You don't know me very well if you think I'm that kind of a glutton for punishment or a masochist. And I say you, I mean impersonal you, whoever you are out there thinking that way. I can just tell you this, we're going to do the work of God. There's no way in the world we can claim to be people of brotherly love if we don't want to share the treasure we have with other people who've never heard it before. It's God's job to decide how many of them act on it, and it always has been for at least 2,000 and really 6,000 years. But I understand people wanting things to go faster. It's natural. When you're waiting for a vacation that's 2 weeks away, people will say, I can't wait. But you know you have to wait. But people say, I can't wait. Well, invariably, they wait those 14 days and the vacation comes. You know, when a baby's coming, a mother gets expectant. She's excited and she hadn't seen her feet for months. And she thinks, when am I going to see my feet again? I can't wait for this baby to come. And the baby eventually comes. You know, we were waiting for our grandson and waiting and waiting. And now he's here and he's, what, 9 months or 9.5 months old. And time moves on. Our other son will be married. I'm excited about it. I'm going to perform his wedding in about 4 weeks. And, you know, counting down the days. Well, pretty soon it'll be over, and then we'll see it in our rearview mirror as an event we enjoyed, and we move on. Eventually, things get done. But it is natural to want them done faster. Now, all of that said, please turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. Verse 48. Mistranslated, it says, be you, it should be become you, therefore perfect. How perfect is that? What's the standard? What do you mean perfect? Well, here it is. Even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Now that is, in plainest terms, a staggering statement and goal and objective for a Christian, to become not only perfect, but as perfect as God in heaven? Would you not say, and frankly this is what hundreds of millions of Protestants say, that's impossible. I remember reading in January 1991 a statement in the PGR saying that it is a near impossible ideal to seek to become like Jesus Christ. Well, I'm afraid there it is in the Bible. Now, there's nothing said there, though, about how long it should or would normally or could be expected to take to become so perfect. It just says become perfect, present progressive. Over a period of time, it's supposed to happen. Now, that said, look at Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3. And verse, well, you can almost pick it up 7 different places. But in verse 12, it says of Philadelphians, and frankly it says this of Ephesians, of Smyrnans, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, and Philadelphia, Laodicea, says it of every era. Verse 12, what it says to Philadelphia, him that overcomes will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out, and you know the rest of the verse. Just as it says in verse 21 to Laodiceans, who eventually will have to do this as well. To him that overcomes will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am sat down with my Father in his throne. Well, if Christ said he overcame and he was sinless to begin with, overcoming is not just overcoming sins, because Christ had no sins to overcome, yet he said he had overcome. He said on his last night on earth, "Be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." Well, he didn't overcome sin. He certainly mastered sin. He made sure that it never for one moment overcame him. So there's no question that Christians have to seek to become perfect and to do this thing called overcoming. Even in the end of the age, whether they are that little group that holds fast, who are known for loving other people, who have all these wonderful qualities, they've got to overcome, or this group that's called poor, wretched, miserable, blind, naked, lukewarm, rich and increased with goods, all kinds of terrible things about it, it's got to overcome too. And eventually, everyone has to become perfect. There's just no question, before we go on, we're to be overcomers when you look at these verses. And I'm going to tell you that Matthew 5:48 may be, in my opinion, okay, it's an opinion, may be one of, if not the hardest verse in the entire Bible to attain to. Can you think of a verse that is harder to encompass than to become as perfect as God the Father in heaven? What other single verse could you think of in the Bible that could match that one? To become as perfect as God in heaven. Is it merely a near impossible ideal where God says, well, I know you really can't do it, but I'll kind of throw it out there and you can shoot for it and see if you can land among the stars? It can certainly seem to be an impossible ideal. I will agree with that. But you know, even the weakest church era, probably of all time, the seventh era, will have to be practicing that verse eventually. It's been my experience that most discouragement that people struggle with is when people find themselves wondering, as per this thing of overcoming, and they look at their own life, they wonder, how fast am I overcoming? Am I overcoming fast enough? Or am I even overcoming at all? The world says that, you know, you just become born again. And of course, the devil brought that idea into the church, what was the church, and people just sort of thought, wow, I can see the kingdom. If you're born again, you can see the kingdom. And here we are. I'm in the kingdom. It's not here in its fullness yet. And we saw all of those word games played about how the fullness of the kingdom is coming, but the kingdom's really here now, because if you're born again now, you can see the kingdom. That means, you know, you got to be able, the kingdom's got to be on earth to be able to see it. And people were sort of massaged into believing they'd kind of arrived. And the next statement that always seems to follow, belief, is once saved, always saved. So once you're in the kingdom, how could you fall out of the kingdom? And all of that supplants the idea that you've got to change. You've got to grow. You've got to overcome. In fact, we have to literally become perfect as God in heaven is perfect. But I'll tell you what, humanly speaking, the devil's pretty smart. His philosophy has a powerful appeal. To just pronounce yourself having come through some kind of religious experience and you have arrived. Those who worry about not growing and overcoming fast enough, who find themselves concerned about it, generally, usually, are those who pretty much assume that they are growing and overcoming fast enough, usually, in fact, are not. I have found that it is usually, it's been my experience over better than 30 years now in the ministry, it has been my experience that generally when people make assumptions within their Christianity, they find themselves in big trouble. It's when people do not assume, Whenever I hear people tell me how humble they are, I know they're not. They've told themselves that often enough that it's been sufficient to believe it. When people believe that they are Philadelphian because they tell themselves they are, or they tell themselves Laodicea is always somebody else somewhere else, it's the surest sign that they're not Philadelphian, that they are Laodicean. You've heard me say that many times, and every way I can find to say it, I'll say it again till the age is out, so that people will be focusing on what it really means to be a Philadelphian so that they can go out and do it. Discouragement swallows a lot of people. People don't all give up Christianity just because they're doctrinally confused or they take a job on the Sabbath or they're thieves at heart and they're just not going to pay their tithes or they're just rebellious and hate government. Well, there's a lot of all of those things out there. There are many reasons why people leave. I almost gave a sermon today. I decided not to. I went back and forth. The sermon on the 15 biggest reasons people leave the church. And they haven't changed. I've given that sermon periodically through the years and modified it, but it basically stays at about 15 reasons, and sometime I'll give them probably pre-Passover next year in a couple of sermons. But again, I find that a lot of people simply quit because they're discouraged. They have maybe grown weary in well-doing. They get depressed. You know, talking with a family last night, they're not with us, but they're probably going to be with us very soon. They were just saying how, you know, thankful they were that I called them back. They were down. They were feeling discouraged and wounded because of things that had happened to them. And they just said, thank you for calling us. You just don't know how much you helped us. And they were fighting discouragement. Now, it was discouragement that was a byproduct of doctrines they wouldn't go along with in another place, but still it was discouragement. And it's discouragement that can make a lot of people quit. I talked to a number of people who say, I've just about had it. A lady wrote me two or three times this week asking me why I was disfellowshipped. In the end, she wants some answers. She says, is this just a matter of ministers have to slam dunk each other and it's one-upsmanship? I mean, what's going on here? I'm just a poor sheep trying to figure out what to do. And it's discouraging. And I often will hear in the next breath, you know, it makes me want to just give it all up. And that's what a lot of them, in fact, do. We must never forget that 60%, if not closer to 70%, of the entire church didn't stay in the Worldwide Church of God, nor did they go to any of the splinter groups. Probably about two-thirds of them just completely blew into the wind, saying, men have lied to me, so I don't have to obey God. That's really what they concluded, however they may have said it in their own mind. Now, there are some steps that people can take to overcoming and to continuing to grow, even in an age when so many are throwing in the towel. Because, brethren, we're the group that can't ever throw in the towel. Even when people all around us, 360 degrees on our horizon, on the compass, are throwing in the towel, we can't. So there are some basic steps that you have to take to walk through this business of overcoming. Now, if human nature is Romans 8:7, we talked about it last week, 2 weeks ago, whatever, you know the verse. Basically, the carnal mind is enmity against God, is not subject to his law, neither indeed can be. If human nature is Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, who can know it? If human nature is Psalm 39, verses 5 and 6, where David said, surely every man in his best state is altogether vanity, and every man walks in a vain show. And if human nature is Mark 7, and let's turn over and actually read that one, because there's several verses there. And of course, these are rhetorical ifs, because human nature is these things. These things are part of human nature. Mark chapter 7 and verse 20. This is the story of the Pharisees who constantly washed their hands to get physical dirt off their hands. It was a tradition of the elders, verse 3. And they constantly were concerned with dirt that they would take into their bodies, that dirt would somehow defile them. And Christ came to the point where he said, no, it's not the dirt that's going to go into you that will defile you, because your intestines will take care of that, and it'll all pass out in the draught, in the sewer. Verse 20, he said, that which comes out of a man, that defiles the man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed, ready, here we go. It's going to sound like a volcano of sewage. Evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. In other words, hey, get your mind off of a little bit of dirt that's going in from the outside and start focusing on huge dirt piles that are already inside that need to come out. That's what he says. Now, if human nature is Romans 8, 7, Jeremiah 17, 9, Psalm 39, 5, and 6, Mark 7, 20 to 23, and you might as well throw in Galatians 5, 19 to 21, if you want to read that. It's an even longer list than Mark. Throw in Romans 1, about verses 29 to 31. It's right in there. Things that God said he would give men over to when they professed themselves to be wise. And let me tell you, human nature is a formidable foe. Anybody who doesn't understand it, frankly, is probably failing at addressing it. Do you think human nature, that is that bad, would just roll over, put its paws in the air the moment you begin to try and grow and overcome as a Christian? Brethren, who are we kidding? A nature this deeply rooted could never just lay down and give up and let you become a perfect overcomer because you sort of decided to. It's not possible. It's a long, hard, tremendous battle that takes, frankly, a lifetime. All right, now, let's move on to another thought as we lay the groundwork. Proverbs 24 and verse 16. People want things to happen fast. Again, I'll confess, I do. I see weaknesses that I have. I wish I could overcome them. And I'll apologize. I'll do things wrong. You do the same, I'm sure. And yet, the weakness is still there. It comes back. I mean, I want the work to grow faster. I want to have all kinds of booklets written. I'd like to be doing broadcasts on the Internet. You have no idea how badly I want to do that. I've got to find time in my day. I'm a pastor. I have to remind myself, no, the scattered brethren have to be cared for. They're sheep who already exist. Their salvation, you know, all of the marbles are on the table for them now. For me to say it's somehow more important to go out and make new sheep before I, as a 30-year pastor, trained to care for the one who's left the 99, before I go out and create the tools to help the already existing sheep, it's just flat out a wrong priority. People say, well, Mr. Armstrong took the gospel to the world first. Let me tell you why he did that. There was no existing flock. How can you feed the flock first unless you take the gospel to the world and create a flock to feed? Do you think Mr. Armstrong, if he came back today, would jump right back into immediately doing all the things necessary to do the work? Let me tell you something. Back in the 70s, and I have to remind myself of this, back in the 70s, when their liberal years were at their fullest and they were only a fraction of as bad as it is in the 90s, in the year 2000, Mr. Armstrong took 3.5 years to put the church back on track, and had a giant ministry and a giant headquarters machine standing behind him. You say, well, where do you get 3.5 years, Mr. Pack? I'll tell you exactly. From May 1978 until the last cap was sort of put in place, November 1981, 42 months, when he corrected makeup. And he said many times, I have to be careful. I can't go too fast. And we still lost thousands, and it was Mr. Armstrong putting the church back on track, not some local pastor, me. You see, or any other local pastor, or even an evangelist. And so, you know, I want it to go faster, but it takes time. It takes time. And there are some fascinating scriptures that force us to accept God's timetable. You know, if people don't see things happening fast enough and want to leave, then fine, let them go to some place where they're not going to have doctrinal perfection, so to speak. I'm sure we're not absolutely perfect, but we're striving to be, where they don't care about gathering the scattered sheep. Let those people take their attitudes and plague some other organization with them and pester some other leader. I hope we all understand. Proverbs 24 and verse 16. And I mean that in a nice way. I hope people will learn to be patient. But I found people often are not patient with themselves either. I'm not a particularly patient human being. I know that. If I was just a real laid-back kind of Gentleman Dave type personality, just sort of slow and easy, then I'll tell you what, I'd have never survived what I have to go through, and probably most of you wouldn't either. But you know, I have to remember now, slow down, because Proverbs 24:16, a just man falls seven times. That isn't really what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew is many times and rises up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief. The characteristic of just people is twofold in there. There's two things you need to notice. Number one, they keep getting up. But you know why they keep getting up? It's because they keep falling down. You can't keep getting up if you're not falling down after you do it. Just means a righteous man. One of the qualities of a Christian is he has to be willing to get up again because he recognizes people fall down over and over again. Therefore, the test is not do they fall down. The Bible says just people fall many times. So if the verse stopped there, you'd have to accept it as a statement out of the Bible. Just men fall many times, period. That's its own statement. But the important part of it is, and they rise up again. The wicked fall into mischief. In other words, they stay there. But don't rejoice when your enemy falls, and let not your heart be glad when he stumbles. I've had people come to me who are with us and say, Mr. Pack, why do you want the other organizations to succeed? And I don't care if they mark me. I don't care what they call me. I still want them to succeed because I know the alternative is, if they aren't at least partially holding fast, they'll fall down, stumble, and land in the ditch, and there's no way they can remain Christian. I want the other organizations to succeed. If they want to merge or split or whatever those groups do, some of them are splitting, some of them are merging, they can't agree doctrinally, that's their business. But I want them all to succeed, and so should you. We shouldn't laugh when other people fall down. And be careful, because some of the people who fall down are just people. How do you know that? Because just men fall many times. So you better be careful. God doesn't even want us to rejoice when our enemies fall or even stumble, because I've seen a lot of people stumble. You've stumbled. You don't always fall just to stumble. Oh, look at that. Ha ha, I'm glad. Or laugh at other people's calamity. Look out. And then there's the danger, like I say, that they may not be enemies at all. They may just be another just man who's stumbling. You know, the Bible says some of them of understanding in the latter part of Daniel 11, about verses 31 to 34, some of them of understanding shall fall to try them. There may be some people out there whose understanding is not fully what it should be or will be. It will be later, who are in the process right now today or tomorrow or Monday, who are going to be falling down. And woe unto us if we're glad about it. We better focus on getting up ourselves. Now, the point here that I'm driving at is it's a characteristic of just men to fall down a lot, but to get back up. Turn to Psalm 37. Psalm 37 and verse 23. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and delights in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. Now, it doesn't say if he fall, because we know why it wouldn't say if he fall, because just men fall down. Good, just men fall down, but he's not utterly cast down. Why? Because God has hold of them. Now, God will let people stumble. He'll let them trip. He'll let them fall down. But what you better remember, and it's a very exciting and very inspiring principle, if you can remember it, is that when you have fallen down, literally remember that God has his hand on you. If he doesn't, then he's lied, because that's what he says that he does. For the Lord upholds him with his hand. Do you walk through life recognizing, A, you're going to fall down a lot, but there's somebody in the third heaven who has his hand on you and is going to help you back up? Now, he's not using that hand to hold you down. So just men who are rising back up again are regularly being pulled up. Watch football this fall. You'll watch teammates will pull each other up after tackles. You know what it is. We're very simple. I mean, we can all get up by ourselves, but it takes longer. If you're laying there on the court and you've been knocked down, or laying there on a football field and you've been knocked down, somebody pulls you up a lot faster. But you still have to help. Because you ever tried to lift dead weight? You ever watched a parent try to lift a child who's dead weight? You know, it's easier. It's much easier to hold the child. We never let our children do this. I've seen children throw tantrums and their parents try to pick them up and they're screaming. They just go dead. And dead weight, a child that weighs 30 or 35 or 40 pounds seems twice or three times as heavy when you're trying to pick them up dead weight as a child that springs up and helps you. So it's a dual effort. All right, we're just laying some groundwork there. With this in mind, that people fall down, but God helps them, and God understands what human nature is, that it is a powerful, deeply rooted thing in human beings, what exactly does God expect when it comes to this thing of overcoming and becoming as perfect as he is? What are God's expectations? Turn back to the Old Testament, Exodus 23, if you would, please. Brethren, let me state, we have to be in this for the long haul. We have to be. I have found there are two types of people out there. There are people who are unstable, and people who are unstable become unstable Christians. But I found that there are people who are stable, but they're not stable Christians. They don't seem to understand exactly what they're supposed to anchor into and stay there. The Bible talks about how the resurrection is an anchor of the soul. You all know what an anchor is. Hebrews says that. You know, an anchor gets thrown down and hopefully hooks on the bottom, and it holds you. You know, I've been out in storms in boats when I've gone fishing or whatever, and I've thrown out an anchor, and there's a lot of wind, and the anchor gets dragged. I've been in boats where we threw two anchors out. One was, well, actually both of them were concrete, and we still get dragged. Exodus 23 and verse 20. Exodus 23 and verse 20. God telling Israel what he would do when they went into the land of Canaan. Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice and provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you shall indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy unto your enemies and an adversary unto your adversaries. For my angel shall go before you and bring you unto the Amorites, the Hittites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, and Jebusites. A lot of ites in there. And I will cut them off. You shall not bow down to their gods. Now we're talking about how Israel would enter the land. What would the process be like when they finally get into the promised land? You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and quite break down their images. And you shall serve the Lord your God, And he shall bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of you. There shall nothing cast their young nor be barren in the land. The number of your days I will fulfill. You'll live out long lives. I will send my fear before you and will destroy all your people to whom you shall come. You know, I cling to that verse because I know God keeps his promise. He can send when he chooses to send nothing else, simply his fear in those who make themselves our opponents. And it works. I will make all your enemies turn their backs unto you. That's because they're running away. That's what it means. Not that they're just going to turn and show you their backside, but they're running away. And I will send hornets before you. You ever see the movie The Swarm years ago? I forget how many years ago it came out. You know, all these disaster movies, The Poseidon Adventure and Towering Inferno and Volcano, and they've been coming out for years now. Earthquake and whatever else. You know, meteors from outer space striking the earth. Well, another one was The Swarm. And God was, I guess, the original author of The Swarm. And how many times he did it, we don't really know. But he said he would send hornets before you. And I've talked about this before, but I've chased hornets. I mean, there are few things, you know, you want to run across worse than hornets. White-faced hornets are some of the toughest hombres out there. And I'm one of these guys. I mean, I've mowed the grass a couple times and brushed the bottom of a hornet's nest. You've heard the term, oh boy, I ran into a hornet's nest. People use that term commonly. And I'll tell you what, they will come flying out. I've had them chase me for a block. You've never seen a man my age run as fast as I have. And still six of them hit me one time. And I ran halfway down a block, circled back, charged around a boulevard, and I thought, this is exciting. And boy, I was running back to the house, and my wife, I mean, I couldn't hold still. My wife was trying to spray this stuff on my back, but, I mean, six hornets had hit me. You know, I know what hornets are like. I saw a guy go up into a tree that died about 4 years ago at our home, and we had an elm tree, and you know, they still get Dutch elm, and I pruned off some branches. It died in 6 weeks. It's a 30-year-old tree. I counted the rings once it was cut down. Big tree, died fast, and hornets will often nest in dead elm trees. They're sweet, and you know, they're sometimes elms have this succulent juice in them. I mean, they're slippery elms. This is actually an American elm. But anyway, the guy wouldn't go up and cut it down because of the hornets in there. So we had to kill the hornets and then cut it down. Anyway, when God said he would send hornets, he knew what he was talking about. They're very aggressive. They're like, you know, African killer bees in one sense. Not quite that bad, but they're bad. Which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before you. Now just try to imagine whole groups of people leaving the towns they're in because hornets chase them out. If you're God and you want to preserve the land, you know, that's one way you do it. Now that's important. Because the next verse says, I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate. Now, most people would think, how about a week? God says, nope, it won't be a year. In other words, it's going to be longer than a year. Because I want to do it carefully and gently, and I want to preserve the land. But it also tells you something about the way God works. Human beings would say, you know, let's have Operation Desert Storm here, God. You know, let's have a six-day war. Like 67, the Israelis and the Arabs, the six-day war. Let's make this quick. I think it took 4 days for the Nazis to overwhelm the Polish cavalry. The first, well, it was a 3 days. The first 3 or 4 days of September 1939 inswept the Nazis, and a bunch of guys on horseback actually met them. There were other elements of the army as well. But people want things to happen fast, and we live in the now generation. And God says, it won't even be a year. I'd be saying, won't be a year, that's good. Was it going to be a month? No, it's much longer. And the beast of the field multiply against you. By little and little I will drive them out from before you, until you be increased and inherit the land. And eventually, you'll look around, and you'll realize a process that went a lot slower than you thought, is over and you've got the land. And the land is still in good shape because I said I would bring you into a land that flows with milk and honey. And I will set your bounds from the Red Sea even to the Sea of the Philistines and from the desert to the river, for I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you'll drive them out before you. You make no covenants with them, and so forth. Pretty basic, but it's how God helps us, brethren. God doesn't help us do things overnight. And I'll tell you why he doesn't. The question has to be, well, why does God want slow, steady progress? Why? Why does the work grow slowly? Why do people in their lives grow slowly? Why do marriages slowly become strong? Why do children grow up slowly? Why does almost anything of worth take a while? Well, a couple reasons. Nothing mysterious here, but first, it teaches us to trust God. I have learned the principle, this is kind of the way I put it, and maybe it will help you. Sudden victory equals sudden vanity. If a victory is sudden, generally people will credit themselves. After all, where is the need to trust God if victories are just slam bang? Kind of at the speed of whiplash or a heartbeat. Where is the need to trust God? Turn to Matthew 13, please. Matthew chapter 13 and verse 5. It talks about the seed that fell on stony places where they had not much earth, and forthwith they sprung up because they had no deepness of earth. They sprang up apparently pretty fast, and when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. Verse 20 explains exactly what it means. But he that received the seed into stony places, the same as he that hears the word and none with joy receives it. And he grows, yet has he not root in himself, but endures for a while. But when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, by and by is offended. The problem is there's not sufficient roots there. I have found that a lot of people are not stable. Some who have even come with us are not stable Christians because they don't have deep enough roots. They think they love the truth. They think they do. They think because they heard their own lips say, I love the truth and I'm coming here and I'm standing up for the truth, that means they do. My thought to them is, when they leave, what happened? What happened? Because we've lost people and we'll lose more. We're gaining more than we lose, but it'd probably be that way for the rest of the age. It's because of their rooting. I just planted an oak tree the other day. It had replaced a tree that was there. Actually, an oak tree was right there. We planted there are two types of oaks, red oak or rubrus, and I replaced it with a swamp oak. Red oaks like to be planted a little high. They don't like to be too wet, and it died real fast. We had a wet summer, as you know, wettest summer ever in this area. And so I replaced it with a swamp oak. And I know it takes about 2 to 3 years for an oak tree to really root in. Then they grow real fast. And so I carefully rooted it in, planted it a little high. It's sort of in a wet area. And it will take off only after it roots in. Some trees, you know, autumn purple ashes, take 5 years to root in. Sometimes longer. Some trees will root in 1 year. Typically a poplar will root in about a year. Robusta poplars, there's lots of different types, will root in about a year. Some will root in the very first year. They'll put out roots faster than bushes do, just tremendously fast. And everything in life that grows on the earth comes down to roots. Why can't people understand that they have to have roots as well? You do. You have to be rooted in. All living things have to be rooted in. They have to be rooted in. There's just no way around it. And Christ, therefore, is not somehow out of bounds when he's talking about people who have root problems. They can be rooted out of the church because they're not rooted deeply enough into the ground. There are plants that understand their environment so well that, for instance, in the Middle East, where it rains couple times a year, a couple seasons a year. The Bible talks about the former and the latter rains. That's the spring and the fall rains. And sometimes God would punish Israel by removing the latter rain, or sometimes he'd remove the former rain, or when he was really punishing them, he'd remove the former and the latter rains. All right, now, that said, there are plants there that understand that they have to endure long droughts, and they will send roots between 100 and 200 feet straight down until they find water. And it can be an absolute desert, but God designed trees to adapt to their environment, and the roots are the way they do that. They have to get to water, or they just die. Or if they get too much water, as the case of this red oak, they get what's called root rot, and too much water, and it rots the roots, and they die. They can't take in the water because it's literally rotting the roots because there's too much. You understand, there are lots of different kinds of root problems. Roots can be poisonous. You plant a Carpathian walnut near a lot of different types of trees, and it puts out a deadly poison that will kill the roots of other trees. I had to learn that. I learned, oh, don't plant Carpathian walnuts near certain types of bushes. I forget the types that I had to dig back out, but I planted other things near them, and they're compatible. So there's lots of lessons in roots. Stony roots grow fast. Actually, stony-rooted plants grow very fast to try to get past stony places. I've watched them. If you've studied roots, chances are a lot of these people put out roots very fast but didn't put them deep enough. If you have real good soil, you don't have to grow as fast because you'll put out more roots. But in stony soil, you put it out faster. You might see a quick burst of growth. You ever see roots trying to wrap around rocks on the sides of cliffs and so forth? You understand. And yet those trees are not very strong when a wind comes. They're not rooted deeply enough. So you have to trust God. It takes a while. Put down deep roots. Sudden victory equals sudden vanity. And second, patient endurance. So God can know for certain we will never quit. We can't have the God give me patience and give it to me now approach. Even Christ's life required 33 and a half years. Now that's a little less than half a normal lifetime of 70 years, but it could have been shorter. God considers somebody an adult when they're 20 in the Old Testament. God could have said, well, Christ counts in the census, he's 20, he's God, I'll just let him start his ministry a decade earlier, and at 23 and a half, we'll let him die for mankind. What difference does it make if he lives to be 33 and a half? Does he really need that maturity? He's God. I'll just get this over with. I miss him. I want him back a decade sooner. Why did God wait for Christ to be 30? You might think about that. Turn to Hebrews chapter 12, because this verse kind of brings it to mind. Why did Moses need 80 years to get ready to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt? Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 1. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. Didn't mean he despised the fact that he had to suffer shame. He despised worrying about it. He despised being concerned with it, is what it means. And is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. That must have been tough, to have the very people that you're trying to save contradict everything you're trying to do, so that if somehow they could defeat your purpose, as they're seeking to do, they would have removed any chance of having a Savior. Lest you be wearied and faint in your minds. Consider what Christ went through for 33 and a half years. Lest you be wearied, and I be wearied, and we faint in our minds. Let me tell you, that's where fainting begins. Usually the mind will tire out before the body. It just will. Thought of this remarkable woman You saw her, what was her, Tilly Tudor, 83 years old, knocked off a bridge by a hit-and-run driver about 5 days ago, and she lay in a swamp about a foot on her side, fell 40 feet in her car, 83 years old, in Florida, below this bridge, and nobody saw her. Well, not exactly. There were a couple of people who did see a hit-and-run driver knock her car right over the bridge, over the barrier, reported it, and two witnesses couldn't get the authorities to look hard enough to find her right there on the bridge. 3 days passed, deadly snakes all around. She had over 100 insect bites. She captured water, laying on her side at an awkward angle with a tremendous bruise over the left side of her forehead and left eye, and captured water she could drink, and all these bugs biting her, hearing snakes all around her. And she had, I think, one cough drop, one piece of peppermint, and maybe one other thing that kept her alive at age 83. And she was preparing to die. You know, she said she cried out, and, you know, for people to see her. And eventually a 15-year-old kid happened to look over the bridge and saw her car laying there in the water. How was it missed? But she didn't quit. She hung in there, and some of the innovative ways she used to sort of practice the law of success, known as resourcefulness, and of course stick-to-itiveness, to keep herself alive, capturing rainwater and wringing out her socks, but she was trapped. Remarkable. Simply a remarkable story. She didn't quit. You know, how many sermons could be given about why and how many people have never quit when faced with incredible odds? Why did God's plan need to be 7,000 years? Tell me. I mean, why couldn't it have been 700 years? We understand that God's plan is to show mankind that his governments don't work, his religions don't work, his cultures don't work, his educational systems don't work, his value systems don't work. So why does it need 7,000 years? Because God knows it does. Because God is patient and careful. Why did Mr. Armstrong take 3.5 years to put the church back on track? Why did God let his ministry last 52 years? That's longer than any of the original apostles, with the exception of John. Why does he give life 70 years? And some people get to live 80 years, and you know the Psalm. Of course, some live longer than that. Methuselah died at 969, and he was still going strong. He died in the flood. Who knows how long he would have lived? Ask old-timers in the church, and you know what they'll tell you? They'll tell you it takes a long time to overcome weaknesses, tendencies, problems, faults, sins, and other things that they are addressing. How is it that the work can be 52 years under Mr. Armstrong, and now years more have passed, approaching 70 years, and God calls it a short work will he do on the earth before the end comes? Brethren, where did God ever say that overcoming is immediate, that it's sudden, that you'll kind of conquer the land, using that analogy there in Exodus 23, overnight? It could never be overnight. Yet people get discouraged because they're not progressing faster. Several key principles. I'm going to give you three for the balance of the sermon. Three principles to keep in mind. Because remember, nothing of any worth or beauty or character happens quickly. A painter can't paint a beautiful Michelangelo or a Rembrandt in a half an hour. A farmer can't plant and bring in a crop from start to finish in a half a day. It takes parts of three seasons. Good marriages take a lifetime. Learning to be a gifted pianist who is also good as well as gifted takes a long time. To become a good carpenter or to build any given house takes a long time. To become a great baseball pitcher takes a long time. It takes a long, long time. To do anything of worth takes a long time. I used to be a painter for a summer, the summer that I was in Indianapolis as an assistant, 21 years old, and I you know, the work was in a budget crunch, and I was the only assistant that went out. They sent me out, but they said, you know, we'll send you out to Indianapolis, Indiana, but you're going to have to get a job. And I'm not trying to brag. I'm just trying to tell you the facts. There were other men who were told that they could go out and they could be an assistant. That was the only year, 1970, where nobody went out because the work was in a budget crunch. I said, look, I will go out. I'll go get a job. Is that okay? Yes, yes. If you can get a job and support yourself, we can't pay you a salary. You can go on out and you can be a ministerial assistant for the summer of 1970. Every year he'd send 10, 15, 20 of them out and so forth. And it was after my junior year, and I wanted the experience, so I became a painter. I'd learned to paint. My dad had been a paint salesman for a while, and he always said, as I've told you, son, I sell it, and you apply it. And so I you know, I did a lot of painting, and I thought, well, I can paint, you know, and make some money. And I rented this motorcycle for the summer, a 65cc old Honda, and I lived in the north side of Indianapolis, and I found a guy in the church who would let me work for him if I met him, but I had to ride to Kokomo, Indiana. And so I buzzed up there on this little bitty motorbike that looked like it was about the right size for somebody half my size. And I, you know, we'd paint from sun up till sundown. And I made enough money, this is the beauty of it, I made enough money in approximately 4 days to support myself for the whole summer. And I got to be a ministerial assistant. And I thought, man, you know, what a blessing. God worked it out because I was willing to go out there. But boy, I will tell you what, painting these houses, I couldn't wait to see them done. It was hot. It was a particularly hot summer. If you've ever, you know, been in central Indiana in July, I'm going to tell you, it was hot. And I couldn't wait to see them done. But when they were done, to stand back and look at an entire house that two of us had painted, it was a wonderful experience to see it done. You know, a desire accomplished is sweet to the soul. Even if that desire accomplished, brethren, is a whole lifetime, not just any given thing like painting a house. There are few things that feel as good as getting things done. This week at headquarters, we got a lot done. We have a staff that works hard and long. They don't even know what it means to go home at 5:30. Forget it. Nobody even looks at their watch until somebody may think to look at their watch, maybe a little after that and so forth. But we just stay until we get the work done. We just do. And it always takes longer than we think. There's always obstacles we didn't anticipate, but we get through them. Overcoming is a lifetime. It's not 3 days. Restructuring the work takes a long time. Turn to Proverbs chapter 12, if you would, please. Proverbs chapter 12. Let's look at a couple of Proverbs there. I've seen a lot of shooting stars in the work, and usually they were the beautiful people who were connected, they were married to the right people, or they were children of senior ministers, and they were given advantages. We all saw it happen, but we sort of lived with it, and you know, it just took place. It just happened. And I've seen a lot of shooting stars, and my wife and I have developed a saying. I probably 25 years ago said this for the first time, maybe, I know it was in the 70s, a lot of shooting stars have come into the work. They burn high, they burn bright, and they burn out. I've seen it. I'm telling you, I've seen it long before the apostasy occurred. Some of the most beautiful, talented people, you remember last week's sermon, are the ones that endure the least. Beauty is vain and favor is deceitful. People who got favor because of their beauty, which already brought them vanity, found that that favor was a very deceitful thing. You could have it one minute and it's gone the next. I watched politicians who trusted in their relationships with people, who trusted in who they knew, not how much Christianity they were living. They were not trusting in Christ. They were trusting in family connections. They were trusting in a boss that liked them. Or maybe somebody else worked for a boss that didn't like him. And I've watched those people build their value system based on an ability to climb, to maneuver through the halls of power in a politically correct fashion, smoothly. I was never very good at it. Matter of fact, I was downright terrible at it. But I saw people who could do it, who knew how to say things and how to couch things and then people would think they were wonderful. Proverbs 12 and verse 24, the hand of the diligent shall bear rule, but the slothful shall be under tribute. I call this the diligence principle, this first key. We've been talking a long time about it without naming it, but it's the diligence principle. The slothful shall be under tribute. That means you're going to be in debt. People who don't work hard are going to be in debt. Slothful could also be translated the deceitful, the people who play games. You know the song, the games people play now every night and every day now. Remember that song how many years ago? Never meaning what they say, and so forth. Proverbs 13 and verse 4, the soul of the sluggard desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made fat. Fat spiritually. Hebrews 6 and verse 11. There are few things that hurt me more as a shepherd than to see people give up because they get swept up into the wrong kind of thinking and you just cannot stabilize them. You can't get them to look at facts. I've watched an entire generation of God's people die in a veritable holocaust because they weren't rooted into the facts of their calling and exactly what they should have believed. 7 years ago, as I was reading in the announcements, I couldn't even get anybody to listen to me. And now look, where are 110,000 people? Where are they? They're just gone. 100,000, whatever it is. Hebrews 6 and verse 11, we desire that every one of you do show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope unto the end, that you be not slothful, but followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises. None of us have been entirely faithful, brethren. I haven't. You haven't. None of us have been entirely patient all the time. I haven't. You haven't. But overall, as a way of life, it has to be that way. You have to acknowledge your weaknesses. You have to look at them and examine them and see which ones are holding you back. Remember the old Parmesan commercial, we will serve no wine before it's time? Some processes can't be rushed, it says. We have to be diligent, which means we stay the course and we will someday bear rule. One of the leaders of the big groups out there is now calling himself, literally, he is literally calling himself a king. That's what he says. He is a king, if I guess which one it is. There's some others who act like kings, but I'll just say we're actually being called to be kings. It's called bearing rule. And one of the ways that will happen is if we are diligently approaching our life. The second key is what I call the each victory principle. The each victory principle. The first one was the diligence principle. This is the each victory principle. Turn to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew 6, a chapter after where we started this sermon, in verse 33. Seek you first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Well-known verse. Take therefore no anxious thought for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day, any given day, is the evil thereof. There are enough things in your life and in your world and in mine today, brethren, to slay us. If we are focusing on tomorrow and not focusing on the evil around us today, we may never get to tomorrow, first of all. But secondarily, each day is a battle in a war filled with 70 times 365 days, a lifetime of 70 years, and that many days per year. Each one of those days has plenty of evil in it. It's sufficient. It's enough. Take a look at the evil in a given day. Just focus on it around you, and you'll realize, yep, there's plenty of evil around me, no doubt about it. Sufficient unto the day. Each day is the evil thereof. Each victory should be counted on a daily basis. If you get through one day, you addressed sufficiently the sufficient evil of that day. That's what you did. That day gets chalked up as a victory in a battle that all put together equals a war. No war, is comprised of one battle. The South won plenty of battles. They lost the war. The Nazis won plenty of battles. They lost the war. We lost, conversely, plenty of battles and won the war. Most wars take, you know, a lot of planning, a lot of preparation, and they aren't over real quickly. I suppose if there was a nuclear war today, it'd be kind of one big bang, it'd be the Big Bang Theory in war all over again, and it'd be a pretty quick battle, I guess. And we'd go into nuclear winter, and that would be the end of that. So maybe wars today would be different, but typically you understand we're to war a good warfare, and most wars are made up of a lot of battles. Sometimes your growth will be so slow it takes other people to even see it. You won't even be able to see it. Sometimes you'll have to go ask God, Father, am I growing? Sometimes you'll ask your friends, your husband, your wife, do you see growth in me? I hope you will, brethren. I hope you will ask others. You know, it says that at the end of the age that God's people will talk often one with another. One of the things they ought to talk about is, do you see growth? Ask each other. You know, if the Bible says you confess your faults one to another, the context, of course, is if a fault is against another person, confess it. Well, then you're going to be talking about certain things from time to time that go wrong with other people and you, between other people and you. And that's going to, by its very nature, make you closer to one another if you take advantage of the opportunity to talk about some things that you're working on. Growth is slow and steady, not whole character changes. You don't overcome anger in a few days, laziness, gossip, lust, vanity, pride, deceitfulness. You say, well, I'm not deceitful. Sure you are. You think that, you've deceived yourself about that, because the heart is deceitful above all things. There's rebellion. There's all kinds of wrong attitudes, covetousness, envy, resentment, outright hatred people have. Those things are overcome over a lifetime. The third and final principle is what I call the use a rifle principle. The use a rifle principle. There's the diligence, the each victory, and the use a rifle principle. Instead of a shotgun, which peppers a lot of problems, it doesn't blow any of them away. Okay? Or instead of a derringer or a pistol on your problems, use a high-powered rifle. Focus on it. You know, get out an elephant gun. Pretend you're whatever, who, Quigley Down Under? I saw the end of that movie. I like that movie. Good movie. But he had this gun that was unbelievable, and it would fire a long way with great accuracy. And, you know, take out a buffalo gun, an elephant gun, and just blow your problem right in two. Don't pepper it. Go after it. Don't pepper problems. Wipe them out. Now, you won't do it necessarily right away. It may take a lot of blasts from your buffalo gun, your elephant gun. You know what an elephant gun is? It's a tremendously powerful rifle that will enter a real thick area of the skull. There's a bump right between and above the elephant's eyes, and you hit the bump. Even though the bone is very thick there, that's where you'll drop an elephant immediately if you penetrate that bone. So you need a very powerful gun. I mean, just to get through the skin of an elephant, I suppose, is its own problem, to go through this thick bone. And you've seen elephants who are being hunted or being culled and so forth, thinned, or poachers, whatever. They always go for that same spot, and it'll just drop an elephant like that. It'll just drop an elephant. So don't pepper your problems, wipe them out. You know, brethren, every sermon cannot say, pray, study, fast, and meditate. I think you know you have to be doing that. Turn to Proverbs, one final verse, by the way. Proverbs chapter 14. But you know to overcome, or any sermon, theoretically, certainly, we're going to talk about growing and overcoming and becoming perfect like God and wiping out your problems over a lifetime and becoming perfect like our Father in heaven would have to include that. So I hope that sort of goes without saying, and yet I've said it. So Proverbs 14 and verse 14 says, "The backslider in heart shall be filled with his own ways." You know, when people are living the wrong way, you have a verse and a promise from God that without any help from you, it will catch up with them. It will fill them up. And a lot of times what fills up backsliders, ironically, is emptiness. They literally are filled with nothing. They fill right up with emptiness. There's nothing of substance there. A good man shall be satisfied from himself. You just feel it. You know it. Nobody can take it away from you. He'll be satisfied from himself. No man, as another proverb says, can intermeddle with his joy. It's his, and he knows it, just as somebody who has slid back. You know what a backslider is? Somebody who slides backwards. They're not moving forward. That journey of, you know, 1,000 miles got derailed, and they start sliding backwards toward where they began. Eventually, they're filled with their own ways. That's a nice way of saying what a man sows, he reaps. Exact same principle. You're filled with your own ways. All birds come home to roost. Don't look for license in your life. There's no shortcuts. You'll be filled with your own ways or satisfied from yourself. Don't try, to quote that commercial, don't try to serve good wine before it's time. You know, there is a true saying, Mr. Armstrong taught us, of course, that we must qualify for the kingdom of God. But a lot of people live their life as though somehow they are disqualifying. There is an aspect of that statement that is, in a certain strange way, true. God is for you. God is not willing that you perish. He is more than happy to believe that we're going to qualify. We almost have to disqualify and give God reasons not to save us as much as we have to qualify and give Him reasons to save us. A lot of people sort of think they're disqualifying. In a funny sort of way, it's encouraging when you stop and realize God wants you to make it. He's got His hand on you. When you fall down, He'll pull you right back up again. That's exactly what He says. Now, that's what He says. His hand is on you. You may not be able to see it, but it is there. And when you fall down and find that it's easier to get up than you thought it was, you realize you got a helping hand off the floor. Brethren, you and I have been called to succeed, not fail. Do you understand that? Do we understand that? We serve a God who is in the success business, not the failure business. There's plenty of people in that business. We've been called to make it, not to fall short of it or miss it. This must always be our focus. And wherever you are, in the overcoming and the striving to become perfect process, wherever you find yourself to be right now, at this moment in time, remember, even the longest journey begins with a single step.